I usually start with that that story of the major patron and this idea that as we walk through a museum and we look at the art, that what we think about the art doesn't affect it one bit. I mean, it stays a masterpiece. But what we think about the art and what we say about the art judges us. I mean, it says who we are. And so as we kind of go through this process, as we think about that, I think that that is probably one of the most important attitudes to keep at the front of our lips, that what we think about the Bible may be the most important thing about us. I'm going to say a quick prayer, and then I'll just jump right in to the story. Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for this day. Thank you for this just truly incredible class that where Tommy and I have planted and watered, you have provided a bounty that's just beyond anything that I could imagine. And I just thank you. Dear Lord, I ask that with this message and with this class and as these weeks stack upon weeks, that you plant this seed deep inside each person here's heart. And that just like on that day of Pentecost when you sent tongues of fire to touch every single person there so that they could speak languages that they didn't know, that you send tongues of fire into this class and give us a Pentecostal gift of hearing. Let each and every one of us hear exactly what we're supposed to hear. Lord, thank you. Thank you. Amen. So, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We're now to a point where this is undisputed. All relevant science agrees that there was a time when the universe didn't exist, and that we're now in a point where the universe does exist. Stephen Hawking says that this is like kryptonite. I'm not sure if he actually said that. I may be adding some color. But he hates the idea that there was a beginning of the universe. Because if there's a creation event, then there must have been a creator. And for there to be a creation event without a creator, the ideas and the story gets more and more fantastical. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so we know from John chapter 1 that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word is kind of a veiled code for Jesus. We know that. And we know from Genesis chapter 1 that the method that God chose to create the world was He spoke it, and He used words. And so we also know from Genesis chapter 1 that the Spirit of God moved over the face of the waters of the earth. And so in the beginning, really from before the beginning, there's God, there's the Father, there's Jesus the Son, and there's the Holy Spirit. In love, in relationship, from before the beginning, the world is created. And if you think about a couple that loves each other, and the husband decides that he's going to build a house because his wife needs a house. And the wife decides that she's going to build a house because her husband needs a house to rule over. And so together they build this house and they set stone upon stone upon stone. And they build this home together out of love, out of service for each other. They believe in each other. And they get to a point where there's nothing they can do to extend their love anymore except a child. And so it's in that spirit that this three in relationship built the earth. And there was nothing they could do to increase their love any more than bring man into it. And so in that spirit, God brings man into the world. And so it's our job, it's our role, it's the whole reason that we were created to increase God's love and to worship and to love Him. We've all got this thing kind of deep inside of us, this sort of hole. And when we get quiet and when we get true, we realize that all the things that we've been putting in there have never really filled it. They've never even begun to. Until we begin to really understand the whole reason that we were created. And so this goes on, this works for a little while, but then sin comes into the garden, into the virtual paradise that God's created. And so in the midst of sin, we have a break, the fall. And at this break, man goes from walking with God, from being in God's presence, to walking away from God. And sometimes we walk, And sometimes we run, and sometimes we just edge like a little girl coming to get a drink and walking back out. But for 4,000 years, man walks away from God. What man walks away from is heaven. C.S. Lewis and a couple of other authors have described heaven as a type of cosmic dance. And if you get in your head around the three, rotating, serving, loving each other, you get this vision of one of those old Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies. And if you've ever watched one, they're kind of tough to watch. But if you ever watched one, you get to the end of it. There's a whole lot of dancing leading up, and you get to the end of it, and it's just Fred and Ginger, and they're there and they're dancing, and they're stepping toward each other, and they serve each other, and they rotate around each other. And if you think about that, if one of them said, "No, I'm not going to step toward you. You step toward me," then they couldn't dance. It wouldn't be a dance. It would be something else. But they continue to move around. And as the camera comes out, you see the first ring of people. And it's another level of people that are all dancing and stepping toward each other, but also around Fred and Ginger. And the camera keeps pulling out. And you end up with hundreds and hundreds of people all dancing, in pulsating movement, serving, moving around. You get this picture of heaven. This picture of heaven is somewhere where you want to be. You want to enter into this dance. And so back on earth, in person number three and in person number four, in Cain and Abel, I see these people that are within me, these archetypes of attitudes that I carry with me every day. First, you've got Abel, under no requirement to make a sacrifice to God. Moses is the one that brings the law and brings the law of sacrifice, but he doesn't come around for 1,500 more years. Under no requirement to lift up a sacrifice, Abel does, and God finds regard for it. Abel becomes kind of the federal head of this part of me and this part of mankind that just can't not be part of this great dance. And he looks behind him and he knows that there's no way for him to be back there. I mean, there's an angel and there's a sword and it's moving every which way. There is absolutely no way for Abel to get back to God, but he can't not do it. And so he takes something that he should have cared about. He takes the first and the best of his flock and he puts it on an altar and he kills it for God. And then we've got this sort of second me that in Cain, also, under no obligation to provide a sacrifice to God, still does. And he takes this grain and he lifts it up to God, and God has no regard for it. And Cain becomes angry. Cain becomes mad. And when he goes and he tells his brother about it, he tells his brother that God has told me that sin is crouching at my door, and that if I don't do anything about it, that it will literally consume me. His brother says, "Uh-huh, that's right. We've all been thinking it." Now, the Bible doesn't tell us that he says that, but you can imagine. And so Cain kills him. He becomes angry and he becomes hard. And I've been that person too. This goes on for 4,000 years. This goes on for 4,000 days in my life where I bounce between Cain and Abel. I manage sin. I move it back and forth. And we have all these characters in the Bible, some of whom can't not be part of what God's built, and others who just won't be part of it. We get to this point where the prophets begin to speak, and the prophets begin to speak in very, very shrill ways. If you've ever read this part of the Bible, it's sort of the right before the New Testament and about this much of the Old Testament. If you've ever read it, it's one of the hardest things for Christians to read, because we look at it as a God that's mad, a God that's been hurt, a God that has rage toward the people. But when you look at it like this, When you look at it backwards on this 4,000-year story, you get this view of a parent whose child is making bad decision after bad decision after bad decision. And this parent is saying, if you can just hold on for another week, if you can just hold on for a few more hours, if you can just hold on for another 100 years, I've got a plan. I can save you. This next part is, and it's a chapter in here, it's called The Weight of the Gospel, and it's sort of a play on words, as in, you know, like a 30-minute weight and then a 30-pound weight. And this part is totally unknowable. I mean, we won't know this until this day. But if you think about the last time that you really had to do something you didn't want to do, I mean, like, maybe you had a conversation you had to have with somebody, or maybe you had to write a check. Maybe you really needed to sit a friend down and say, this has gone on long enough. We're Americans, so we did it. I mean, you just gut it up and you just did it, you know? But at the same time, God couldn't just do it. God didn't just do it. Humanity literally could not bear the weight of the gift that he was going to bring. I got this vision when I was going through this at the very first, and it was this vision of the Garden of Eden, and the very minute that Eve's teeth broke the skin of that apple, that Jesus burst into the throne room. Jesus laid himself down at the feet of God and said, "Can I go? Can you throw a cross in the middle of Eden? Can I climb on it? And can I make this right?" And with tears, both of them, God picks Jesus up and he says, "No, that humanity can literally not bear the weight of what you will bring." And so for 4,000 years, God waits. Another thing that's totally unknowable is what the cost is to him of leaving this great, great party, this great dance, and coming down to earth to deal with us. I think about my wedding. My wedding is a time like that. My wedding was the greatest because I had all of my friends from all of my different lives. I had my high school friends, I had my college friends, I had my friends after college, and everybody came. We had this great party. What would have been the cost for me to leave for an hour or for 2 hours? Now, I know God's outside of time, but there must have been some cost for me to leave that party and to go to Peachtree and Pine and to feed people that hate me. And so the very minute that humanity could bear the weight of the gospel, Jesus comes. There's probably hundreds, but I've kind of, I found seven, and we'll talk about them in here, and I probably won't share seven, but there were seven things that were going on in the world at that time that had never happened before. Rome was tough to deal with. It was not a government you wanted to live under, but there was law. And so for the first time in a few hundred, maybe 1,000 years, for the first time in a while, if you put a boat, if you put a man or a letter or an alm on a boat in Israel and sent it to Rome, barring weather, it was going to get there. The seas were safe. There was no piracy on the Mediterranean. The Romans also had an incredible love of infrastructure. And so for the first time, if you were going to send a person out to a far end of the kingdom to spread the gospel, there was a good road that could take them there. Before the Romans, there were the Greeks. And the Greeks had a lot of fighting. But one thing everybody was on the same page about was Hellenization. And it sounds, you know, you probably knew someone in college named Helen and she was sweet. This was not sweet. This was really, really terrible. It essentially meant that there were a lot of things about it. But one of the things was that everyone was going to speak Greek. And so whatever language you spoke or knew or your kids knew, they would now learn Greek. And so bought with a lot of blood and with a lot of money and with a lot of sweat. If you wrote a book in Greek, most of the known world could read it. My favorite one is King Herod. Bill preached about him this morning. There are three or four Herods in the Bible, but this was Herod the Great. And Herod the Great was a seriously bad dude. Bill didn't include this part of the... If you had kept reading the scripture, you would have seen that because the three wise men did not return to tell him which baby was the king, he just said, well, let's just kill all the babies. Herod was a lover of pleasure. If there were seven deadly sins, he was earnestly looking for an eighth. Herod, out of his pride and out of his greed, had taken the alms that had come in from the to the temple, and he built Jerusalem into the greatest city that the world knew at that time. Rome was Rome. Rome was like Washington, D.C. That's where the laws got made. It was a great city. But Jerusalem was New York. Jerusalem was where you took your kids on the big trip. It was the center of culture. It was the center of architecture. It was the center of literature. It made it possible that one man could walk over a very small part of the earth and the entire world would know it. The temple complex, it was said at this time that if you had never gazed on Jerusalem in the morning, you had never seen a beautiful city. And so the very minute that humanity could bear the weight of the gospel, Jesus comes. Jesus brings us three things. The first thing Jesus brought us was a way. This way was not a prescriptive way. We all know a prescriptive way. When you're sick, you go to the doctor, and the doctor gives you a prescription. And we never think of turning around and saying, well, do you take this? Because the doctor would say, well, I didn't present with those things. You know, you've got something wrong with you. If you take this, you will get well. Jesus brought us a descriptive way. He said, watch me. And that way was, if you want to go up, you've got to go down. If you want to be exalted, you must become humble. If you want to be rich, you must become poor. This was hard back then. I mean, you literally had people that had memorized this much of the Bible that came from 400-year traditions of being priests and scribes. These people were up. These people had put a lot of time and a lot of resources into being up. As you think about it, it sounds a lot like us today. I mean, I walk out of here and I could make six really, really bad decisions and I'd still be up. When I go to... I've had an opportunity to feed some men, some homeless men down on downtown. And we all kind of get ready and get everything done, but then there's only so many spots for, you know, people to give or to be given the food out. So I usually just grab some waters or some coffee and just go down the line and talk to all the people that are in line. And I don't want to blanket this and say that, you know, every homeless person is homely or is holy, but you get to about the fifth conversation about Jesus and you're like, something's going on here. What's going on is those people don't have to go two steps and they're down. And Jesus literally is bearing them up. Becca Stevens, do y'all know her? She has a really great ministry in Nashville. Thistle Farms, right? She's awesome. It's sort of a prison ministry, but it's more than that. She said, if you want to see the face of Jesus, go to jail. For us, today, we have to orchestrate ways to diminish ourselves. We've got to orchestrate ways to serve sacrificially. And so if you think about this cosmic dance, this becomes sort of the first piece of that cosmic dance, the step. The step of that dance is a sacrificial service. But if you've ever done a dance, you know that If you just know the step, you're probably not going to make it out of like the high school dance. There's more than that. Jesus brought us a way. Jesus also brought us a truth. And that truth was that you think religion is going to save you. And he's talking to Pharisees at this time who thought religion was going to save them. He says, you think religion's going to save you. You think I obey, therefore God accepts me. But God owes me. God owes me a good life. He owes me a family. He owes me well kids. And if God ever gets to a point where he doesn't provide those, I'll get them myself. I'm out. This was hard for folks in that day, but it's hard for us too. I mean, we look and we say, I'm at least in the top 50% in ethics in my profession. People just do this. This is just how this business works. We come to church to check the box. Jesus said, you don't know this yet, but I have come to give you everything. I've come to scatter my body on the cross, to hang on it. And when that becomes the center of your life, it's your absolute pleasure to obey. We'll talk a little bit in this class about your fundamental. It's really not fair to ask somebody, what's your fundamental? So I won't. But if over these course of the weeks you try to discern what it is, I'll give you a couple of cheaters. If you've ever walked into a room and you felt less than some people in there, maybe they are thinner than you, maybe they're prettier than you, maybe they make more money than you, maybe they are smarter than you or have better jobs or are more powerful than you. If you've ever felt less than someone else, where you go next is your fundamental. If you say, yeah, but I'm from this family, or if you say, yeah, but I've got some really great clothes on today, or yeah, but I'm training for a triathlon. Where you go next is your fundamental. If you've ever been in danger of losing something, if you've ever been in danger of losing your job or losing your house or your retirement accounts or a child, or someone's literally stuck a gun in your face, where you go next is your fundamental. When that is that an all-powerful God, creator of the universe, came down, walked the earth, and climbed onto a cross for you, when that's your fundamental, and when the fact that he did it because he loved you, when that sinks in, when that's your core, you got it. It's your absolute pleasure to obey. This becomes the beat. And you know that if you've got the step and you've got the beat, you're good enough to travel in a regional dance company. But heaven doesn't accept good. Heaven accepts great. This beat is love. This beat is an overwhelming love that Jesus had for us and that we pour out on him because of this sacrifice, because of this thing that we love. It's not enough, though. I mean, this regional dance company, you've seen people that serve like this. You've seen people that serve sacrificially. I mean, they give everything to this people or this thing that they serve. And they love them. I mean, they love the people that are there. Maybe they're homeless. Maybe they're orphans. Maybe they have AIDS. Maybe they have some kind of a need, but they have the sacrificial service and they have the love down. But without the third, without the belief, it's like a person that lives in a mansion and they begin taking little pieces off of it to burn for heat. And pretty soon, you've stayed warm for as long as you can because you have totally disassembled anything that you've got. You begin to consume your love, you begin to consume your service because there's no belief. Jesus brought us a way, Jesus brought us a truth, but He also brought us a life. This life is His life. It was the sacrifice that we demanded. Have you ever thought why God paid so dearly for us? I mean, Kurt, if you owed me $1,000, I could snap my fingers, I could tear up the note, I could say we're good, right? Does anybody here think God couldn't have done that? I mean, the sin was against Him. He could have leveled the accounts. He could have said we're good. In order for the sacrifice, for us to understand the sacrifice, it had to be huge. And if you're God, creator of heaven and earth, how do you give something huge? How much is a lot of money to Warren Buffett? God didn't want to just justify the accounts. God wanted to win us. And to do that, it had to be something big. Jesus, on a cross, naked, cut, was the sacrifice that each and every single one of us required. Jesus on the cross paid for those sins. Jesus' resurrection was the receipt, stamped paid. We've got the step. We've talked about the tune. This belief in Jesus and the cross is the veritable music of the dance. It is what heaven runs on. You've got to feel it. You've got to know it. If you've got the step and you've got the beat, but you've never heard the music before, you're nowhere. You're not making the company. We're going to stop just for a minute. And everybody just take a breath. And we're going to, this is like a quick reset in between. I've got one more story and then we'll finish. We can talk about it. But I've got just one more story and then and we'll be done. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, but you don't have to if you don't want to. It's very important that you put yourself in this story. So do your best. Also, at the end, I'm going to ask three questions. And if you're gutsy or if you want to, you can answer the questions. And we can stop. This doesn't have to be just one way. So if you feel like you want to answer the question, then, you know, let's talk about it. But there'll be three questions, and then we're done, and we'll really talk about it. So don't feel like you can or you can't answer the questions. So close your eyes. Take a breath and close your eyes. I want you to imagine that you're a parent and that you've got two kids, a boy and a girl. And your boy is literally a high school All-American. He plays a sport that you love like you have never seen. He's smart, he's really smart, and he cares for people, and he loves people. He graduates from high school, and he gets a full scholarship, and he chooses the college that he goes to, because it's where he thinks you wanted him to go. He loves you. He honors you. He serves you. He graduates from college, and he marries a girl that you love. And she loves you, and she loves him, and he loves her, and he loves you. And when you get together, you literally orbit around each other. The time you spend with them is so fulfilling. It's not like those things you look forward to, and then when you get there, you're kind of like, ugh, this wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be. It's you look forward to it, and when you get there, it's even better. You love them. He gets a job, and he works for a little while, and it's great work. It's the work, and you're so proud of him. But it's not that kind of pride, the bad kind of pride. It's not the Herod kind of pride. It's the kind of pride that you can't believe that you are in some way associated with this person. And when you realize that this person loves you, it almost takes you apart. So your son applies to law school. He gets in and he wants to go for a really great reason, and he moves off to a far off city. And you still see him and you call him and you talk all the time, but they're living far away. But remember, you've also got a daughter. Your daughter is beautiful. And she is so, so, so strong. But from an early age, your daughter has shown an ability to make, just an unbelievable ability to make bad decisions. And if you've ever been around someone like this, you know that for a while they have a lot of decisions between good and bad. But then pretty soon, and after, as time goes on, they are deciding between multiple bad decisions. There are no good decisions left. She steals from you. She curses you. She hates you. And it gets to a point where having her in your house, her physical presence hurts you. And she feels the exact same way. And so over the last couple of years, you've been estranged and you haven't seen her. One day you're in your kitchen and you're thinking about her, and you've been trying to find her, but you get a phone call all of a sudden. And the phone call goes something like this: "Hey, you don't know me, but I'm a friend of your daughter's, and we're into some really bad stuff with some even worse people." And she's crying and apologizing, and she says, I don't know how we're ever going to get out of this. These guys, I heard them talking, and they said that they had sold your daughter. And they'd sold her to some men, and they're from overseas, and they're going to be here in about 4 hours. And I don't know what to do. I don't know. If we're at this address, and we're only going to be here for a little bit longer. And if you ever want to see her again, and the phone goes dead. And you're standing there in your kitchen, and you look down at this pad where you've written this address, and you realize that your daughter is in the same far-off city that your son is. There's no way you can get there in 4 hours. But we come to the question, the first question. Do you send him? Do you send your son to save your daughter? The second question is, if you know, and I can't tell you how you know, but if you know that your son will die in that house, do you send him to save your daughter? And the third question, again, I can't tell you how you know, but if you know that your son will die a horrible, excruciating death, that there's no chance they both make it out, But if you know, do you send him? If you don't know that he'll save her. If all you know is that she'll get 3 steps outside that door and standing there on the porch, she'll decide to run home to you or to turn around and walk back inside that house into the life that she built. The fact is that we serve a God who doesn't require us to ask this, to answer these questions. Jesus provided us a descriptive way, not a prescriptive way. But this story became real to me when I realized that every single morning when I wake up, I'm that girl, standing on that porch, fully understanding the sacrifice that was made. And I decide whether I break off that porch and run home to a Heavenly Father, or I turn back around and walk into that house, back into the life that I've built. My wife, she's so great. She said, well, you know, there's a third option. And that third option is to just hang out on the porch. To continue to understand the sacrifice. To go back in for a glass of water or to grab some money or to put something on. To effectively manage sin in our lives. I'm not going to look at that much porn. I'm not going to do that many drugs. I'm not going to hurt that many people. I'm going to use the money that I've made from widows and orphans for some good. But to never really break off that porch and to run home to God. This is what we're going to talk about over these next 7 weeks. This story breaks down into about 12 parts. And my prayer, the reason that I've put this together is that we all become those people that can't not be part of heaven. And that together we practice this step of sacrificial service. That together we're able to feel the beat of love. And that we believe. That we believe and accept this great sacrifice. Does anyone have any thoughts on this or want to talk about it?